and death his legacy. The prophet came out of the south with a flag in his right hand and an axe handle in his left to preach the creed of Americanism. He spoke to the poor and the angry, to the confused and to the fearful, and in them he woke a new determination. For his words were like a fire in the land, and wherever he stopped to speak, there the multitudes arose to march behind him. His name was Norval Arlington Beauregard, and he had been a governor before he became a prophet. He was a big, stocky man, with round black eyes and a square face that flushed blood red when he got excited. His heavy, bushy eyebrows were perpetually crinkled down in suspicion, while his full lips seemed frozen in a sneering half-smile. But his disciples did not care what he looked like, for Norval Arlington Beauregard was a prophet, and prophets are not to be questioned. He did no miracles, but still they gathered to him, north and south, poor and affluent, steel workers and factory owners, and soon their numbers were like unto an army, and the army marched to the music of a military band. "Maximilian Delorier is dead," said Maximilian Delorier aloud to himself as he sat alone in a darkened, book-lined study. He laughed a low, soft laugh. A match flared briefly in the darkness, flickered momentarily as he touched it to his pipe, and winked out. Maxim Delorier leaned back in the plush leather armchair and puffed slowly. "No," he thought, "it doesn't work. The words just don't sound right. They've got a hollow ring to them. I'm Maxim Delorier, and I'm alive." "Yes," answered another part of him, "but not for long. Quit fooling yourself. They all say the same thing now. Cancer. Terminal. A year at most. Probably not even that long." "I'm a dead man, then," he told himself. "Funny. I don't feel like a dead man. I can't imagine being dead. Not me. Not Maxim Delorier." He tried it again. "Maximilian Delorier is dead," he said firmly to the silence. Then he shook his head. "It still doesn't work," he thought. "I've got everything to live for. Money, position, influence, all that and more. Everything." The answer rang ruthless and cold through his head. "It doesn't matter," it said. "Nothing matters anymore. Nothing except that cancer. You're dead. A living dead man." In the dark, silent room, his hand trembled suddenly, and the pipe flew from his grasp and spilled ashes on the expensive carpet. His fists clenched, and his knuckles began to whiten. Maximilian Delorier rose slowly from the chair and walked across the room, brushing a light switch as he passed it. He stopped before the full-length mirror on the door and surveyed the tall, gray-haired reflection that stared back from the glass. There was a curious whiteness about the face, he noted, and the hands were still trembling slightly. "And my life?" he said to the reflection. "What have I done with my life? Read a few books, driven a few sports cars, made a few fortunes. A blast. One long, wild blast. Playboy of the Western world." He laughed softly, but the reflection still looked grim and shaken. "But what have I accomplished? In a year, will there be anything to show that Maxim Delorier has lived?" He turned from the mirror with a snarl. A bitter, dying man, with eyes like the gray ash of a fire that has long since gone out. As he turned, those eyes drank in the gathered remains of a life, sweeping over the rich, heavy furniture, the polished wooden bookcases with their rows of heavy, leather-bound volumes, the cold, sooty fireplace, and the imported hunting rifles mounted in a rack above the mantelpiece. Suddenly, the fire burned again. With quick strides, Delorier crossed the room and yanked one of the rifles from its mounting. He stroked the stock softly with a trembling hand, but his voice when he spoke was cold and hard and determined. "Damn it," he said. "I'm not dead yet." He laughed a wild, snarling laugh as he sat down to oil the gun. Through the far west, the prophet stormed, spreading the word from a private jet. Everywhere the crowds gathered to cheer him, and husky steelworkers lifted up their children on their shoulders so they could hear him speak. The long-haired hecklers who dared to mock his cause were put down, shouted down, and sometimes beaten down. "I'm for the little man," he said in San Diego. "I'm for the good, patriotic Americans who get forgotten today. This is a free country, and I don't mind dissent, but I'm not about to let the commies and the anarchists take over. Let's let 'em know they can't fly the communist flag in this country if there are any red-blooded Americans left around. And if we have to bust a few heads to teach 'em, well, that's okay, too." And they flocked to him, the patriots and the super-patriots, the vets and the GIs, the angry and the frightened. They flew their flags by day and read their Bibles by night and pasted Beauregard stickers on the bumpers of their cars. "Any man has got a right to dissent," the prophet shouted from a platform in Los Angeles. "But when these long-haired anarchists try to impede the progress of the war, why, that's not dissent, that's treason. And when these traitors try to block troop trains carrying vital war materials to our boys overseas, I say it's time to give our policemen some good stout clubs, untie their hands, and let 'em spill a little commie blood. That'll teach those anarchists to respect the law." And all the people cheered and cheered, and the noise all but drowned out the faint echo of jackboots in the distance. Reclining in the deck chair, the tall, gray-haired man glanced at the copy of the New York Times lying across his lap. He was a nondescript sort of fellow, with a worn, off-the-rack sports jacket and a pair of cheap plastic sunglasses. Few would notice him in a crowd. Fewer still would look closely enough to recognize the dead man who once had been Maximilian Delorier. A half-smile flickered across the dead man's lips as he read one of the first-page stories. The headline read, "Delorier Fortune Liquidated," in prim gray type. Below, in smaller print, a somber subhead observed that "English millionaire vanishes. Friends believe money deposited in Swiss banks." Yes, he thought, how appropriate. The man vanishes, but the money gets the headlines. I wonder what the papers will say a year from now. Something like, "Heirs await reading of will," perhaps? His eyes left the article and wandered upward across the page, coming to rest on the lead story. He stared at the headline in silence, a frown set across his features. Then, slowly and carefully, he read the article. When he finished, Delorier rose from the chair, folded the paper carefully, and dropped it over the rail into the murky green water that churned lustily in the liner's wake. Then he shoved his hands into his jacket pockets and walked slowly back to his stateroom in the economy section of the ship. Below, the newspaper tumbled over and over in the turbulence caused by the great liner's passing, until it finally became waterlogged and sank. It came to rest at last on the muddy, rock-strewn bottom, where the silence and the darkness were eternal. And the crabs scuttled to and fro across the fading front-page photo of a stocky, square-faced man with bushy eyebrows and a crooked sneer. The Prophet swung east with a vengeance, for here was the homeland of the false seers who had led his people astray. Here was the stronghold of those who opposed him. No matter. Here his crowds were even greater, and the sons and the grandsons of the immigrants of the last century were his to a man. So here, Norval Arlington Beauregard chose to attack his enemies in their own lair.
"I'm for the little man," he said in New York City. "I support the right of every American to rent his house or sell his goods to whoever he so chooses, without any interference by briefcase-toting bureaucrats and egghead professors who sit up in their ivory towers and decide how you and me have to live."
And the people cheered and cheered, and they waved their flags and said the Pledge of Allegiance and chanted "Beauregard, Beauregard, Beauregard" over and over again until the arena rocked with the noise. And the Prophet grinned and waved happily, and the Eastern reporters who covered him shook their heads in disbelief and muttered dire things about charisma and irony.
"I'm for the working man,"
the Prophet told a great labor convention in Philadelphia.
"And I say all these anarchists and demonstrators better damn well quit their yapping and go out and get jobs just like everybody else. You and me had to work for what we had, so why should they get pampered by the government? Why should you good folks have to pay taxes to support a bunch of lazy, ignorant bums who don't want to work anyway?"
The crowd roared its approval, and the Prophet clenched his fist and shook it above his head in triumph, for the word had touched the souls of the workers and the laborers, the strainers and the sweaters, the just-haves of a nation. And they were his. They would follow false gods no longer. So they all stood up and sang the Star-Spangled Banner together. In New York, Maxim Delorier caught the first bus from customs to the heart of Manhattan. He carried only one small suitcase packed with clothing, so he did not bother to stop at a hotel. Instead, he went straight towards the financial district, to one of the city's largest banks. "I'd like to cash a check," he said to a teller, "on my bank in Switzerland." He scribbled in his checkbook sloppily, ripped the page loose, and shoved it across the counter. The teller's eyebrows shot up slightly as he noticed the figure. He said. "I'll have to check this out, sir. I hope you don't mind waiting a few moments. You do have identification, of course, Mr.—" He glanced at the check again. "Mr. Lawrence," he concluded. Delorier smiled amiably. "Of course," he said. "I'd hardly try to cash a check of this size without proper identification." 20 minutes later, he left the bank, walking with measured confidence down the avenue. He made several stops that day, before he finally checked into a cheap hotel for the night. He bought some clothing, several newspapers, a large number of maps, a battered used car, and a collection of rifles and pistols. He took plenty of ammo, and made sure every rifle had a telescopic sight. Maximilian de Laurier stayed up late that night, bent over a cheap card table in his hotel room. First, he read the newspapers he had purchased. He read them slowly and carefully, and over again. Several times he got up and placed phone calls to the paper's information services, and took down careful notes of what they told him. And then he spread out his maps and studied them intently, far into the morning. Selecting those he wanted, he traced a heavy black line across them, constantly referring back to his papers as he worked. Finally, near dawn, he picked up a red pencil and circled the name of a medium-sized city in Ohio. Afterward, he sat down and oiled his guns. The prophet returned to the Midwest with a fury, for here, more than anywhere except in his homeland, he had found his people. The high priests who had fanned out before him sent back their reports, and they all read the same way. Illinois was going to be good, they said. Indiana was even better. He'd really clean up in Indiana. And Ohio? Ohio was great. Ohio was fantastic. And so the prophet crisscrossed the Midwest, bringing the word to those who were ripe for it, preaching the creed of Americanism in the heartland of America.
Chicago is my kind of town, he said repeatedly as he stumped through Illinois. You people know how to handle anarchists and communists in Chicago. There's a lot of good, sensible, patriotic folks in Chicago. You're not about to let those terrorists take over the streets from good, law-abiding citizens in Chicago.
And all the people cheered and cheered, and Beauregard led them in a salute to the police of Chicago. One long-haired heckler yelled out, "Nazi!" But his lone shout was lost in the roar of the applause. Except at the back of the hall, two burly security guards noted him, nodded to each other, and began to move swiftly and silently through the crowd.
"I'm not a racist," the prophet said as he crossed the border to speak in northern Indiana. "I stand for the rights of all good Americans, regardless of race, creed, or color. However, I support your right to sell or rent your property to whoever you choose, and I say every person ought to work like you and me without being allowed to live in dirt and ignorance and immorality on a government handout. And I say that looters and anarchists ought to be shot."
And all the people cheered and cheered, and then went out to spread the word to their friends, their relatives, and their neighbors. "I'm no racist, and Beauregard's not one either," they'd tell each other. "But would you want one to marry your sister?" And the crowds grew larger and larger each week. And as the prophet moved east into Ohio, a dead man drove west to meet him.
"Is this room satisfactory, Mr. Laurel?" asked the thin, elderly landlady, holding the door open for his inspection.
Maxim de Laurier brushed past her and deposited his suitcases on the sagging double bed that stood against one wall. He smiled amiably as he surveyed the dingy Coldwater flat. Crossing the room, he lifted the shade and glanced out the window.
"Oh, dear," said the landlady, fumbling with her keys. "I hope you won't mind the stadium being located right next door. There's going to be a game next Saturday, and those boys do make a dreadful lot of noise."
She punctuated her sentence with a sharp stomp, as her foot came down to crush a cockroach that had crawled out from under the carpet. De Laurier brushed aside her fears with a wave of his hand.
The room will be just fine, he said. I rather enjoy football anyway. And from here I'll have a fine view of the game. The landlady smiled weakly.
Very well, she said, holding out the key. I'll take the week's rent in advance, if you don't mind.
When she left, Delorier carefully locked the door and then pulled up a chair in front of the window. Yes, he thought. A fine view. A perfect view. Of course, the stands are on the other side, so they'll probably have the platform facing that way. But that shouldn't pose any problems. He's a big man, a stocky man, probably quite distinctive even from behind. And those arc lights will be a big help. Nodding in satisfaction, he rose and returned the chair to its normal place. Then he sat down to oil his guns. It was quite cold out, but the stadium was packed nonetheless. The grandstands were crammed with people, and an overflow crowd had been permitted to drift out onto the field and squat in the grass at the foot of the platform. The platform itself, draped in red, white, and blue, had been erected on the 50-yard line. American flags flew from staffs at both ends of the platform, with a speaker's podium situated between them. Two harsh white spotlights converged on the rostrum, adding to the garish brilliance of the stadium's own arc lights. The microphones had been carefully hooked up to the stadium's loudspeaker system and tested over and over again. It was lucky that they were working, for the roar was deafening when the prophet stepped up to the podium and subsided only when he began to speak. And then the hush was sudden and complete, and the call of the prophet rang out unchallenged through the night. Time had not dimmed the fire that burned in the soul of the prophet, and his words were white hot with his anger and his conviction. They came loud and defiant from the platform, and echoed back and forth through the grandstands. They carried far in the clear, cold night air. They carried to a dingy, cold water flat where Maxim Delorier sat alone in the darkness, staring out his window. Leaning against his chair was a high-caliber rifle, well-oiled and equipped with a telescopic sight. On the platform, the prophet preached the faith to the patriots and to the frightened. He spoke of Americanism, and his whip-like words flailed the communists, the anarchists, and the long-haired terrorists who were haunting the streets of the nation. Ah, yes, thought Delorier. I can hear the echoes. Oh, how I can hear the echoes. There was another who attacked the communists and the anarchists. There was another who said he would save his nation from their clutches. And I say to you good folks of Ohio that when I'm in charge, the streets of this country are going to be safe to walk on. I'm going to untie the hands of our policemen and see that they enforce the laws and teach these criminals and terrorists a few lessons. A few lessons, thought Delorier. Yes, yes, it fits. It fits. The police and the army teaching lessons. And such effective teachers. With clubs and guns as study aids. Oh, Mr. Beauregard, how well it all fits.
And I say that when our boys, our fine boys from Mississippi and Ohio and everywhere else, are fighting and dying for our flag overseas, that we've got to give them all the support we can here at home. And that includes busting the heads of a few of these traitors who defile the flag and call for an enemy victory and obstruct the progress of the war. I say that it's time to let them know how a patriotic, red-blooded American takes care of treason.
Treason,
thought Delorier. Yes, treason was what he called it, too. That other one, so long ago. He said he would get rid of the traitors in the government. The traitors who had caused the nation's defeat and humiliation. Delorier slid the chair back slowly. He dropped to one knee and lifted the rifle to his shoulder.
I'm no racist, but I say that these people ought to...
Delorier's face was chalk white, and the gun was unsteady in his hands.
So sick,
he whispered hoarsely to himself.
So very, very sick. But do I have the right? If he is what they want, can I have the right, alone, to overrule them in the name of sanity?
He was trembling badly now, and his body was cold and wet with his sweat, despite the chilling wind from outside. The prophet's words rang all around him, but he heard them no longer. His mind flashed back to the visions of another prophet and the promised land to which he led his people. He remembered the echo of great armies on the march. He remembered the shriek of the rockets and the bombers in the night. He remembered the terror of the knock on the door. He remembered the charnel smell of the battlefield. He remembered the gas chambers prepared for the inferior race. And he wondered, and he listened, and his hands grew steady. If he had died early, said Maximilian Delorier, alone to himself in the darkness, how would they have known what horror they had averted? He centered the crosshairs on the back of the prophet's head, and his finger tightened on the trigger, and the gun spoke death. Norval Arlington Beauregard, his fist shaking in the air, jerked suddenly and pitched forward from the platform into the crowd below. And then the screaming started, while the Secret Service men swore and rushed towards the fallen prophet. By the time they reached him, Maximilian Delorier was turning the ignition key in his car and heading for the turnpike. The news of the prophet's death rocked a nation, and the wail went up from all parts of the land.
They killed him, they said. Those damn commies knew that he was the man who could lick them, so they killed him.
Or sometimes they said,
it was the niggers, the damn niggers. They knew that Beauregard was going to keep them in their places, so they killed him.
Or sometimes,
it was those demonstrators, goddamn traitors. Bo had them pegged for what they were, a bunch of anarchists and terrorists. So they killed him, the filthy scum.
Crosses burned across the land that night, and all the poles turned sharply upward. The prophet had become a martyr. And 3 weeks later, Beauregard's vice presidential candidate announced on a nationwide television address that he was carrying on.
Our cause is not dead, he said. I promised to fight on for Beau and all that he stood for, and we will fight to victory.
And all the people cheered and cheered. A few hundred miles away, Maxim Delorier sat in a hotel room and watched, his face a milk-white mask.
No,
he whispered, choking on the words.
Not this. This wasn't supposed to happen. It's wrong. All wrong.
And he buried his head in his hands and sobbed,
My God! My God! What have I done?
And then he was still and silent for a long time. When he rose at last, his face was still pale and twisted, but a single dying ember burned still in the ashes of his eyes. "Maybe," he said. "Maybe I can still..." And he sat down to oil his gun.